"Renegade Segula," she muttered, then shook her head and collected up the deck. Her version was Baruchan, with a few cards of her own added, including one for the city, in this case Darujistan, and another. But no, she would not think of that one, not unless she had to. A tremor of fear rushed through her. The wooden cards felt cold in her hands. She decided on a spiral field and was not at all surprised when she set the center card down and saw that it was the city, a silhouetted familiar skyline at dusk, with the glow of blue fires rising up from below, each one like a submerged star. She studied it for a time, until those fires seemed to swim before her eyes, until the dusk the card portrayed began to flow into the world around her, one bleeding into the other, back and forth, until the moment was fixed, time pinned down as if by a knife stabbed into the table. She was not seeking the future. Prophecy was far too dangerous with all the converging powers, but the present. This very instant, each strand's point of attachment in the vast web that now spanned Darujistan. She set down the next card, High House Shadow, the rope, patron of assassins. Well, that was not too surprising, given the latest rumors. Yet she sensed the relationship was more complicated than it at first appeared. Yes, the guild was active, was snarled in something far bloodier than it had anticipated. Too bad for the guild. Still, the rope never played one game. There were others beneath the surface. The obvious was nothing more than a veil. The third card clattered onto the tabletop, and she found her hand would not rest, flinging out the next card and yet another. Three tightly bound, then. Three cards forming their own woven nest. Obelisk, Soldier of Death, and Crown. These needed a frame. She set down the sixth card and grunted, Knight of Darkness. A faint rumble of wooden wheels, a chorus of moans drifting like smoke from the sword in the knight's hands. Thus, the rope on one side, the knight on the other. She saw that her hands were trembling. Three more cards quickly followed, another nest. King of High House Death, King in Chains, and Decembre, Lord of Tragedy. Knight of Darkness as the inside frame. She set down the other end and gasped, a card she wished she had never made, a tyrant. Closing the field, the spiral was done. City and tyrant at beginning and end. Tissera had not expected anything like this. She was not seeking prophecy. Her thoughts had been centered on her husband and whatever web he had found himself trapped in. No, not prophecy, nothing on such a grand scale as this.
I see the end of Darujistan. Spirit save us. I see my city's end. This, Torvald, is your nest. Oh, husband, she murmured, you are in trouble indeed.
Her eyes strayed once more to the rope.
Is that you, Cotillion? Or has Vorkan returned? It's not just the guild. The guild means nothing here. No, there are faces behind that veil. There are terrible deaths coming. Terrible deaths!
Abruptly she swept up the cards, as if by that gesture alone she could defy what was coming, could fling apart the strands and so free the world to find a new future. As if things could be so easy, as if choices were indeed free. Outside, a cart clunked past, its battered wheels crackling and stepping on the uneven cobbles. The hoofs of the ox pulling it beat slow as a dirge, and there came to her the rattle of a heavy chain, slapping leather and wood. She wrapped the deck once more and returned it to its hiding place, and then went to another, this one made by her husband. Perhaps indeed he'd thought to keep it a secret from her, but such things were impossible. She knew the creak of every floorboard, after all, and had found his private pit only days after he'd dug it. Within, items folded in blue silk, the silk of the blue Moranth. Tor's loot. She wondered again how he'd come by it. Even now, as she knelt above the cache, she could feel the sorcery roiling up thick as a stench, reeking of watery decay. The warren of ruse, no less, but then perhaps not.
This, I think, is elder. This magic, it comes from Mael. But then what connection would the blue Moranth have with the elder god?
She reached down and edged back the silk, a pair of sealskin gloves glistening as if they had just come up from the depths of some ice-laden sea. Beneath them, a water-etched throwing axe, in a style she had never seen before, not Moranth for certain. A sea raider's weapon, the inset patterns on the blue iron swirling like a host of whirlpools. The handle was an ivory tusk of some sort, appallingly oversized for any beast she could imagine. Carefully tucked in to either side of the weapon were cloth-wrapped grenados, 13 in all, one of which was, she had discovered, empty of whatever chemical incendiary was trapped inside the others. An odd habit of the Moranth, but it had allowed her a chance to examine more closely the extraordinary skill involved in manufacturing such perfect porcelain globes, without risk of blowing herself and her entire home to pieces. True, she had heard that most Moranth munitions were made of clay, but not these ones, for some reason. Lacquered with a thick, mostly transparent gloss that was nevertheless faintly cerulean, these grenados were, to her eye, works of art, which made the destruction implicit in their proper use strike her as almost criminal.
"Now, dear husband, why do you have these? Were they given to you, or did you, as is more likely, steal them?"
If she confronted him, she knew, he would tell her the truth. But that was not something she would do. Successful marriages took as sacrosanct the possession of secrets. When so much was shared, certain other things must ever be held back. Small secrets, to be sure, but precious ones nonetheless. Tisera wondered if her husband foresaw a future need for such items. Or was this just another instance of his natural inclination to hoard? A quirk both charming and infuriating, sweet and potentially deadly, as all the best ones were. Magic flowed in endless half-visible patterns about the porcelain globes, another detail she suspected was unusual.
Ensorcelled munitions. What were the Blue Moranth thinking?
Indeed, whatever were they thinking?
Two empty chairs faced Crupper. A situation most peculiar and not at all pleasing. A short time earlier, they had been occupied. Scorch and Leff, downing a fast tankard each before setting out to their place of employment, their nightly vigil at the gates of the mysterious estate and its mysterious lady. Oh, a troubled pair indeed, their fierce frowns denoting an uncharacteristic extreme of concentration. They'd swallowed down the bitter ale like water, the usual exchange of pleasant idiocies sadly muted. Watching them hurry out, Crupper was reminded of two condemned men on the way to the gallows, or a wedding, proof of the profound unfairness of the world. But fairness, while a comforting conceit, was an elusive notion, in the habit of swirling loose and wild about the vortex of the self. And should the currents of one collide with those of another, why, fairness ever revealed itself as a one-sided coin. In this fell clash could be found all manner of conflict, from vast continent-spanning wars to neighbours feuding over a crooked fence-line. But what significance these philosophical meanderings? Nary effect upon the trudging ways of life, to be sure. Skip and dance on to this next scene of portentous gravity, and here, arriving hooded as a vulture through the narrow portal of the Phoenix Inn, none other than Torvald Nom. Pausing just within the threshold, answering Salty's passing greeting with a distracted smile, and then to the bar, where Mies has already poured him a tankard. And in reaching over to collect it, Torvald's wrist is grasped, Mies pulling him close for a few murmured words of possible import, to which Torvald grimaces and then reluctantly nods, his response sufficient for Mies to release him. Thus sprung, Torvald Norm strode over to smiling Crupper's table and slumped down into one of the chairs.
"It's all bad," he said. "Crupper is stunned, dear cousin of Ralik, at such miserable misery, such pessimistic pessimism. Why, scowling Torvald has so stained his world that even his underlings have been infected. Look, even here thy dark cloud crawls darkly Crupper's way. Gestures are necessary to ward off sour infusion."
And he waved his hand, crimson handkerchief fluttering like a tiny flag.
"Ah, that is much better.
Be assured, Torvald, Crupper's friend, that bad is never as bad might be, even when it's very bad indeed.
Ralik left a message for me. He wants to see me.
Crupper waggled his brows and made an effort at leaning forward, but his belly got in the way, so he settled back again, momentarily perturbed at what might be an expanding girth. But then, it was in truth a question of angles, and thus a modest shift in perspective eased his repose once more, thank the gods.
Unquestionably, Ralik seeks no more than a cheery greeting for his long-lost cousin. There is, Crupper proclaims, no need for worry.
Shows what little you know, Torvald replied. I did something terrible once, horrible, disgusting, and evil. I scarred him for life. In fact, if he does track me down, I expect he'll kill me. Why do you think I ran away in the first place?
A span of many years, said Crupper, weakens every bridge until they crumble at a touch, or if not a touch, then a frenzied sledgehammer.
Will you speak to him for me, Crupper?
Of course, yet alas, Ralik has done something terrible and horrible and disgusting and evil to poor Crupper, for which forgiveness is not possible.
What? What did he do?
Crupper will think of something. Sufficient to wedge firmly the crowbar of persuasion until he cannot but tilt helpless and desperate for succor in your direction. You need only open wide your arms, dear friend, when said moment arrives.
Thanks, Crupper, you're a true friend. And Torvald drank deep.
No truer, no lie, it is true. Crupper blesses you, alas, with none of the formal panoply accorded you by the Blue Moranth. Oh, had Crupper been there to witness such extraordinary, indeed singular, honorificals! Salty, sweet lass, is it not time for supper? Crupper withers with need. Oh, and perhaps another carafe of vintage.
Hold it, Torvald Norm cut in, his eyes sharpening. What in Hood's name do you know about that, Crupper? And how? Who told you? No one could have told you, because it was secret in the first place.
Calmly, please, calmly, Crupper's dearest friend.
Another wave of the handkerchief, concluded by a swift mop as sweat had inexplicably sprung to brow.
Why, rumours! Not a chance! Then, a dying confession? We're about to hear one of those, yes.
Crupper hastily mopped some more.
Source escapes me at the moment. Crupper swears. Why, are not the Moranths in a flux?
They're always in a damned flux, Crupper.
Indeed. Then, yes, perturbations among the black, upon gleaning hints of said catechism, or was it investiture? Something religious, in any case.
It was a blessing, Crupper.
Precisely. And who among all humans more deserved such a thing from the Moranth? Why, none, of course, which is what made it singular in the first place, thus arching the exoskeletal eyebrows of the black, and no doubt the red and gold and silver and green and pink. Are there pink Moranths?
Crupper is unsure.
So many colours, so few empty slots in Crupper's brain. Oh, spin the wheel and let's see explosive mauve flash into brilliant expostulation, and why not? Yes, 'twas the mauve Moranth, so verbose and carelessly so, although not so carelessly as to reveal anything to anyone but Crupper, and Crupper alone, Crupper assures you. In fact, so precise their purple penchant for verbosity that even Crupper's recollection of the specific moment is lost, to them and to Crupper himself. Violate a violet if you dare, but they're not telling, nor is Crupper.
And he squeezed out a stream of sweat from his handkerchief, off to one side, of course, which unfortunately coincided with Salty's arrival with a plate of supper.
Thus did Crupper discover the virtue of perspiratory reintegration, although his subsequent observation that the supper was a tad salty was not well received, not well received at all. Astoundingly, Torvald quickly lost all appetite for his ale, deciding to leave, rudely so, in the midst of Crupper's meal. Proof that manners were not as they once were. But then, they never were they?
Hasty departure to echo Torvald Nom's flight back into the arms of his wife, out into the dusk when all paths are unobstructed, when nothing of reality intrudes with insurmountable obstacles and possibly deadly repercussions. In a merchant house annex down at the docks,
In the second-floor loft above a dusty storeroom with sawdust on the floor, a well-born young woman straddles a once-thief on the lone narrow cot with its thin, straggly mattress, and in her eyes darkness unfolds, is revealed to the man savage and naked, raw enough to startle in him a moment of fear. Indeed, fear. At the moment, Cutter could not reach past that ephemeral chill, could not find anything specific. What Chalice's eyes revealed was all-consuming, frighteningly desperate, perhaps depthless and insatiable in its need. She was unmindful of him, he could see that. In this instant, he had become a weapon on which she impaled herself, ecstatic with the forbidden, alive with betrayal. She stabbed herself again and again, transformed into something private, forever beyond his reach. And, yes, without doubt, these were self-inflicted wounds, hinting of an inwardly directed contempt, perhaps even disgust. He did not know what to think, but there was something alluring in being faceless, in being that weapon, and this truth shivered through him as dark as all that he saw in her eyes.
Apsala, is this what you feared? If it is, then I understand. I understand why you fled. You did it for both of us.
With this thought, he arched, groaning, and spilled into Chalice Vidicus. She gasped, lowered herself onto him, sweat on sweat, waves of heat embracing them. Neither spoke. From outside, gulls cried to the dying sun, shouts and laughter muted by walls, the faint slap of waves on the broken, crockery-cluttered shore, the creak of pulleys as ships were loaded and offloaded. From outside, the world as it always was. Cutter was now thinking of Silara, of how this was a kind of betrayal, no different from Chalice's own. True, Silara had said often enough that theirs was a love of convenience, unbound by expectations. She'd insisted on that distance, and if there had been moments of uncontrolled passion in their lovemaking, it was the selfish kind, quickly plucked apart once they were both spent. He also suspected that he had hurt her. With their landing in his city, some part of him had sought to sever what they had had aboard the ship, as if by closing one chapter every thread was cut and the tale began anew. But that wasn't possible. All breaks in the narrative of living had more to do with the limits of what could be sustained at any one time, the reach of temporary exhaustion. Memory did not let go. It remained the net dragged in one's wake, with all sorts of strange things snarled in the knotted strands. He had behaved unfairly, and that had hurt her, and indeed hurt their friendship. And now it seemed he had gone too far to ever get back what he now realized was precious, was truer than everything he was feeling now, here beneath this woman. It said joy's quick crash was weighted in truth. All at once Chalice, sprawled prone atop him, felt heavier. In her own silence, Chalice of House Vidicus was thinking back to that morning, to one of those rare breakfasts in the company of her husband. There had been sly amusement in his expression, or at least the tease of that emotion, making his every considerate gesture slightly mocking, as if in sitting facing one another at the table they were but acting out clichéd roles of propriety, and finding, it seemed, a kind of comfort in the ease of their mutual falsehoods. She suspected that some of Gorlas's satisfaction involved a bleed-over into her private activities, as if it pleased him to take some credit for her fast-receding descent into depravity, that his unperturbed comfort was in fact supportive, something to be relied upon, a solid island she could flail back to when the storm grew too wild, when her swimming in the depths took on the characteristics of drowning. Making her so-called private activities little more than extensions of his possession. In owning her, he was free to see her used and used up elsewhere. In fact, she had sensed a sexual tension between them that had not been there since, that had never been there before. She was, she realized, making herself more desirable to him. It seemed a very narrow bridge that he chose to walk. Some part of her, after all, was her own, belonging to no one else, no matter what they might believe, and so she would, ultimately, be guided by her own decisions, the choices she made that would serve her and none other. Yes, her husband played a most dangerous game here, as he might well discover. He had spoken, in casual passing, of the falling out between Chardon Lim and Hannot Orr, something trivial and soon to mend, of course. But moments were strained of late, and neither ally seemed eager to speak to Gorlas about any of it. Hannot Orr had, however, said some strange things offhand to Gorlas in the few private conversations they'd had, curious, suggestive things, but no matter. It was clear that something had wounded Hannot Orr's vaunted ego, and that was ever the danger with possessing such an ego, its constant need to be fed, lest it deflate to the prods of sharp reality. Chardon Lim's mood, too, had taken a sudden downward turn, one day veritably exalted, the next dour and short-tempered. Worse than adolescence, those two. You'd think there was a woman involved. Chalice had affected little interest, finding, to her own surprise, that she was rather good at dissembling, at maintaining the necessary pretensions. The mistress of the house, the pearlescent prize of the master, ever smooth to the touch, as delicate as a porcelain statue, indifferent to the outside world and all its decrepit, smudged details. This was the privilege of relative wealth, after all, encouraging the natural inclination to manufacture a comforting cocoon, keeping out the common indelicacies, the mundane miseries, all those raw necessities, needs, wants, all those crude stresses that so strained the lives of normal folk. Only to discover, in gradual increments of growing horror, that the world within was little different, that all those grotesque foibles of humanity could not be evaded. They just reared up shinier to the eye, like polished baubles, but no less cheap, no less sordid. In her silence, Chalice thought of the gifts of privilege, and oh, wasn't she privileged indeed? A rich husband getting richer, one lover among his closest allies, and that was a snare she might use again if the need arose, and now another, one Gorlas knew virtually nothing about, at least she didn't think he did. Sudden rapid flutter of her heart.
What if he has someone following me?
The possibility was very real, but what could she do about it? And what might her husband do when he discovered that her most recent lover was not a player in his game? That he was, in fact, a stranger, someone clearly beyond his reach, his sense of control. Would he then realize that she, too, was now beyond his control? Gorlas might panic. He might, in truth, become murderous.
Be careful now, Crow Cutter. What we have begun is very dangerous.
He said nothing in reply, and after a moment she pushed herself off him and rose to stand beside the narrow bed.
He would kill you, she continued, looking down on him,
seeing once again how the years had hardened his body, sculpted muscles bearing the scars of past battles. His eyes, fixed on her own, regarded her with thoughts and feelings veiled, unknowable.
He's a duelist, isn't he?
She nodded.
One of the best in the city.
Duels, he said, don't frighten me.
That would be a mistake, Cutter. In any case, given your station, it's doubtful he'd bother with anything so formal. More like a half dozen thugs hard to get rid of you, or even an assassin.
So, he asked, what should I do about it?
She hesitated, and then turned away to find her clothes.
I don't know. I was but warning you, my love.
I would imagine you'd be even more at risk. She shrugged.
I don't think so. Although, she added, a jealous man is an unpredictable man.
Turning, she studied him once more.
Are you jealous, Cutter?
Of Gorlas Vidicus?
The question seemed to surprise him, and she could see him thinking about it.
Title and wealth, yes, that would be nice. Being born into something doesn't mean it's deserved, of course, so maybe he hasn't earned all his privileges, but then maybe he has. You'd know more of that than I would.
That's not what I meant. When he takes me, when he makes love to me.
Oh, does he?
Occasionally.
Make love, or just make use of you?
That is a rather rude question.
Years ago, he would have leapt to his feet, apologies tumbling from him in a rush. Now he remained on the bed, observing her with those calm eyes. Chalice felt a shiver of something in her, and thought it might be fear. She had assumed a certain control, over all of this, over him, and now she wondered. What, he now asked, do you want from me, Chalice? Years and years of this, meeting in dusty, abandoned bedrooms? Something you can own that Gorlas does not? It's not as if you'll ever leave him, is it?
You once invited me to run away with you.
If I did, he said, you clearly said no. What has changed?
I have.
His gaze sharpened on her. So now you would? Leave it all behind? The estate? The wealth? He waved languidly at the room around them. For a life of this? Chalice, understand, the world of most people is a small world. It has more limitations than you might think.
And you think it's that different among the noble-born?
He laughed. Fury hissed through her, and to keep from lashing out, she quickly began dressing.
It's typical, she said, pleased at her calm tone. I shouldn't have been surprised. The low-born always think we have it so easy, that we can do anything, go anywhere, that our every whim is answered. They don't think...
She spun to face him, and watched his eyes widen as he comprehended her anger.
You don't think that people like me can suffer.
I never said that.
You laughed.
Where are you going now, Chalice? You're going back to your home, your estate, where your handmaids will rush to attend to you, where another change of clothes and jewelry awaits, after a languid bath, of course. He sat up abruptly. The ship's carpenter who stayed in this room here, well, he did so because he had nowhere else to go. This was his estate, temporary, dependent on the whim of House Vidicus, and when his reason for being here was done, out he went, to find somewhere else to live, if he was lucky. He reached for his shirt. And where will I go now? Oh, out onto the streets, wearing the same clothes I arrived in, and that won't change any time soon. And tonight, maybe I can wheedle another night in a room at the Phoenix Inn. And if I help in the kitchen, I'll earn a meal, and if Mies is in a good mood, then maybe even a bath. Tomorrow, the same challenges of living, the same questions of what next. He faced her, and she saw amused irony in his expression, which slowly faded. Chalice, I'm not saying you're somehow immune to suffering. If you were, you wouldn't be here, would you? I spoke of limited worlds. They exist everywhere, but that doesn't mean they're all identical. Some are a damned sight more limited than others.
You had choices, Cutter, she said. More choices than I ever had.
You could have told Gorlas no when he sought your hand in marriage.
Really? Now that reveals one thing in you that's not changed. Your naivete.
He shrugged. If you say so. What next, Chalice? His sudden, seemingly effortless dismissal of the argument took her breath away.
It doesn't matter to him. None of it. Not how I feel, not how I see him. I need to think, she said, inwardly flailing.
He nodded as if unsurprised.
Tomorrow evening, she said, we should meet again.
A half grin as he asked, to talk?
Among other things.
All right, Chalice. Some thoughts, possessing a frightening kind of self-awareness, knew to hide deep beneath others, riding unseen the same currents, where they could grow unchallenged, unexposed by any horrified recognition. One could always sense them, of course, but that was not the same as slashing through all the obfuscation, revealing them bared to the harsh light and so seeing them wither into dust. The mind ran its own shell game, ever amused at its own sleight-of-hand misdirection. In truth, this was how one tended to live, from moment to moment, with the endless exchange of denials and deference and quick winks in the mirror, even as inner proclamations and avowals thundered with false willpower and posturing conviction. Does this lead one into unease? Chalice Vidicus hurried home, nevertheless taking a circuitous route as now and then whispers of paranoia rose in faint swells to the surface of her thoughts. She was thinking of Cutter, this man who had once been Crocus. She was thinking of the significance in the new name, the new man she had found. She was thinking also, there beneath the surface, of what to do with him. Gorlas would find out, sooner or later. He might confront her, he might not. She might discover that he knew only by arriving one afternoon at the loft in the annex and finding Cutter's hacked, lifeless corpse awaiting her on the bed. She knew she was trapped in ways a free man like Cutter could never comprehend. She knew as well that the ways out were limited, each one chained to sacrifices, losses, abandonments, and some despicable. Yes, that was the only word for them.
Despicable.
She tasted the word anew, there in her mind, contemplated whether she was in fact capable of living with such a penance.
But why would I? What would I need to see done to make me see myself in that way? How many lives am I willing to destroy in order to be free?
The question itself was despicable, the stem to freedom's blessed flower. To grasp hold was to feel the stab of countless thorns. Yet she held tight now, riding the pain, feeling the slick blood welling up, running down. She held tight to feel, to taste, to know what was coming. If
I decide to accept this.
She could wait for Gorlas to act, or she could strike first. A corpse lying on the bed, a mangled rose lying on the floor. Cutter was not Crocus. She could see that, yes, very clearly. Cutter was dangerous. She recalled the scars, the old knife wounds, sword wounds even, perhaps. Others that might have been left by the punch of arrows or crossbolts. He had fought, he had taken lives, she was certain of it. Not the boy he'd once been.
But this man he now is, can he be used? Would he even blink if I so asked? Should I ask? Soon? Tomorrow?
Thus exposed, one must recoil indeed, but these were deep-run thoughts, nowhere near the surface. They were free to flow, free to swirl round unseen, as if detached from all reality. But they weren't, were they? Detached from all reality. Oh no, they were not. Does this lead one into unease? On a surge of immense satisfaction, Barathol Mekar's rather large fist smashed into the man's face, sending him flying back through the doorway of the smithy. He stepped out after him, shaking the stinging pain from his hand.
"I will be pleased to pay the guild's annual fees, sir," he said, "when the guild decides to accept my membership. As for demanding coin while denying my right to run my business, well, you have just had my first installment."
A smashed nose, blood pouring forth, eyes staring up from a puffiness burgeoning to swallow up his features, the guild agent managed a feeble nod.
"You are welcome," Barathol continued, "to come back next week for the next one, and by all means bring a few dozen of your associates. I expect I'll be in an even more generous mood by then."
A crowd had gathered to watch, but the blacksmith was disinclined to pay them any attention. He rather wanted word to get out, in fact, although from what he'd gathered, his particular feud was already a sizzling topic of conversation, and no doubt his words just spoken would be quoted and misquoted swift as a plague on the hot winds. Turning about, he walked back into his shop. Chara stood near the back door, wearing his heavy apron with its spatter of burn holes, revealing the thick weave of askia grass insulation beneath the leather, the only plant known that did not burn, even when flung into a raging fire. Oversized gloves of the same manufacture covered his hands and forearms, and he was holding tongs that gripped a fast-cooling curl of bronze. Chara's eyes were bright, and he was smiling.
"Best get that back into the forge," Barathol said.
As expected, business was slow. A campaign had begun, fermented by the guild, that clearly involved the threat of a blacklist that could, and would, spread to other guilds in the city. Barathol's customers could find themselves unable to purchase things they needed from a host of other professions, and that, of course, would prove devastating. And as for Barathol's own material requirements, most doors had already begun closing in his face. He was forced to seek out alternatives in the black market, never a secure option. As his friend Mallet had predicted, Malazan's resident in the city had been indifferent to all such extortions and warnings against taking Barathol's custom. There was, evidently, something in their nature that resisted the notion of threats, and in fact being told they could not do something simply raised their hackles and set alight a stubborn fire in their eyes. That such a response could prove a curse had been driven home with the slaughter at Corolles, and the grief that followed remained deeply embedded in Barathol, producing within him a dark, cold rage. Unfortunately for the latest agent from the Guild of Blacksmiths, something of that fury had transferred itself into Barathol's instinctive reaction to the man's demand for coin. Even so, he had not come to Darujistan to make enemies, yet now he found himself in a war, perhaps more than one at that. No wonder, then, his foul mood. He made his way into the workyard, where the heat from the two stoked forges rolled over him in a savage wave. His battle-axe needed a new edge, and it might do to fashion a new sword, something he could actually wear in public. Barathol's new life in Darujistan was proving anything but peaceful. Belam Nom was, in Murillo's estimation, the only student of the dueling school worthy of the role. 15 years of age, still struggling with the awkwardness of his most recent growth spurt, he approached his studies with surprising determination. Even more astonishing, the lad actually wanted to be here. In the prolonged absence of Stony Menarchus's attention, it had fallen to Murillo to assume most of the school's responsibilities, and he was finding this very distant relation of Ralik and Torvald in every respect a nom, which alone encouraged a level of instruction far beyond what he gave the others. The young man stood before him sheathed in sweat, as the last of the class hurried out through the compound gate, the echoes of their voices quickly fading, and Murillo sensed that Belam was far from satisfied with the torturously slow pace of the day's session.
"Master," he now said, "I have heard of an exercise involving suspended rings. To achieve the perfect lunge, piercing the hole and making no contact with the ring itself."
Murillo snorted.
"Yes, useful if you happen to be in a travelling fair or a circus. Oh, for certain, Belam, point control is essential in fencing with the rapier. I wouldn't suggest otherwise, but as an exercise, I am afraid its value is limited."
"Why?"
Murillo eyed the young man for a moment and then sighed.
"Very well. The exercise requires too many constraints, few of which ever occur in the course of a real fight. You achieve point control, useful point control, I mean, when it's made integral to other exercises. When it's combined with footwork, distance, timing, and the full range of defense and offense demanded when facing a real living opponent. Spearing rings is all very impressive, but the form of concentration it demands is fundamentally different from the concentration necessary in a duel. In any case, you can spend the next 2 months mastering the art of spearing a ring, or 2 months mastering the art of staying alive against a skilled enemy, and not just staying alive, but presenting a true threat to that enemy in turn."
He shrugged.
"Your choice, of course."
Belam Nom grinned suddenly, and Murillo saw at once how much he looked like his oh-so-distant cousin.
"I still might try it. In my own time, of course."
"Tell you what," Murillo said. "Master spearing a suspended ring at the close of a mistimed lunge, an off-balance recovery to your unarmed side, two desperate parries, a toe stab to your opponent's lead foot to keep him or her from closing, and a frantic stop thrust in the midst of a backpedaling retreat. Do that, and I will give you my second best rapier."
"How long do I have?"
"As long as you like, Belam."
"Extra time with an instructor," said a voice from the shaded colonnade to one side. "He's not free."
Murillo turned and bowed to Stony Menarchus.
"Mistress, we were but conversing."
"You were giving advice," she cut in, "and presenting this student with a challenge. The first point qualifies as instruction. The second is an implicit agreement to extracurricular efforts on your part at some time in the future."
Belam's grin had broadened.
"My father, mistress, will not hesitate to meet any extra expense, I assure you."
She snorted, stepping out from the gloom.
"Any?"
"Within reason, yes."
She looked terrible, worn, old, her clothes dishevelled. If Murillo had not known better, he would judge her as being hungover, a condition of temporary, infrequent sobriety to mark an alcoholic slide into fatal oblivion. Yet he knew she was afflicted with something far more tragic. Guilt and shame, self-hatred and grief. The son she didn't want had been taken from her. To imagine that such a thing could leave her indifferent was not to understand anything at all. Murillo said to Bellum,
"You'd best go now."
They watched him walk away.
"Look at him,"
Stoney muttered as he reached the gate. "All elbows and knees."
"That'll pass,"
he said. "A stage, is it?"
"Yes."
And of course he knew this particular game, the way she spoke of Harlow by not speaking of him, of the life that might await him, or the future taken away from him, stolen by her cruel denial. She would inflict this on herself again and again at every opportunity. Seemingly innocent observations, each one a masochistic flagellation. For this to work, she required someone like Murillo, who would stand and listen and speak and pretend that all this was normal, the back and forth and give and take, the blood pooling round her boots. She had trapped him in this role, using the fact of his adoration, his love for her, and he was no longer certain that his love could survive such abuse.
"The world is small and getting smaller."
He had walked the pauper pits south of the city, just outside the wall between the two main trader gates. He had looked upon scores of recent unclaimed dead. It was, in fact, becoming something of a ritual for him, and though he had only second-hand descriptions of Harlow, he did his best, since no one who knew the boy would accompany him. Not Stoney, not Merla, nor Bedeck. On occasion, Murillo had been forced to descend into one of the pits to make closer examination of some small body, a soft, lime-dusted face, eyes lidded shut as if in sleep, or, on occasion, scrunched in some last moment of pain, and these mute, motionless faces now paraded in his dreams at night, a procession of such sorrow that he awoke with tears streaming from his eyes. He told Stoney none of this. He'd said nothing of how his and Crupper's inquiries among the sailors and fisherfolk had failed to find any evidence of someone press-ganging a 5-year-old boy, and that every other possible trail thus far had turned up nothing, not even a hint or remote possibility, leaving at last the grim likelihood of some fell mishap, unreported, uninvestigated. Just another dead child abandoned long before death's arrival, known only in the records of found corpses as the twice dead.
"I'm thinking of signing over my stakes in the school," Stoney now said, "to you."
Startled, he turned to stare at her.
"I won't accept."
"Then you'd be a fool, as if I didn't already know that. You're better suited. You're a better teacher. I barely managed any interest in this from the very start. It was always the coin, and now I find I could not care less. About the school, the students, even promising ones like Nom there. I don't care about anything, in fact."
"Including you, Murillo."
Yes, he heard that unspoken addition without the need for her to actually say it aloud. Well, she would, of course, want to push him away. Much as she needed him to play those self-wounding games with her, she needed even more the solitude necessary for complete self-destruction. Isolation was more than a simple defense mechanism. It also served to prepare one for more severe punishments, possibly culminating in suicide. On another level, she would view her desire to drive him off as an act of mercy on her part, but that was a most irritating form of self-pity. He had given his heart to the wrong woman.
"Timing, Bellum Nom, is everything. With sword in hand, with love in hand. Oh well, I'd figured it out with a rapier, at least." "Don't make that decision just yet," he said. "I have one more thing I can try." "It won't be pleasant, but you don't need to know that."
Stoney simply turned away.
"I'll see you tomorrow, then."
Many adults, in the indurated immobility of years, acquire a fear of places they have never been, even as they long for something different in their lives, something new. But this new thing is a world of the fantastical, formless in answer to vague longings, and is as much defined by absence as presence. It is a conjuration of emotions and wishful imaginings, which may or may not possess a specific geography. Achieving such a place demands a succession of breaks with one's present situation, always a traumatic endeavour, and upon completion, why, sudden comes the fear. Some do not choose the changes in their lives. Some changes no one in their right mind would ever choose. In Karul's bar, a once soldier of the Malazan Empire stands tottering over the unconscious form of her lover, whilst behind her paces Antsy, muttering self-recriminations under his breath, interrupted every now and then with a stream of curses in a half-dozen languages. Blend understood all that had motivated Picker to attempt what she had done. This did little to assuage her fury. The very same High Denal healer who had just attended to her had set to a thorough examination of Picker as soon as Antsy had returned, with his charge lying in the bed of a hired ox cart, only to pronounce that there was nothing to be done. Either Picker would awaken or she wouldn't. Her spirit had been torn loose and now wandered lost. The healer had left. In the main room below, Dyker and Silara sat in the company of ghosts and not much else. Although still weak, Blend set out to collect her weapons and armor. Antsy followed her into the corridor. "What are you planning?" he demanded, almost on her heels as she went into her own room. "I'm not sure," she replied, laying out her chain hauberk on the bed, then pulling off her shirt to find the padded undergarment. Antsy's eyes bugged slightly as he stared at her breasts, the faint bulge of her belly, the sweet... Blend tugged on the quilted shirt and then returned to the hauberk. "You'll need to wrap me," she said. "Huh? Oh, aye, right. But what about me?" She regarded him for a moment.
"You want to help?"
He half snarled in reply.
"All right," she said. "Go find a couple of crossbows and plenty of quarrels. You're going to cover me for as long as that's possible. We don't walk together."
"Aye, Blend." She worked the hauberk over her head and pushed her arms through the heavy sleeves. Antsy went to the equipment trunk at the foot of the bed and began rummaging through its contents, looking for the swaths of black cloth to bind the armor close and noiseless about Blend's body. "Gods below, woman, what do you need all these clothes for?"
"Banquets and soirees, of course."
"You ain't never been to one in your life, woman."
"The possibility always exists, Antsy. Yes, those ones, but make sure the drawstrings are still in them."
"How do you expect to find the nest?"
"Simple," she said. "Don't know why we didn't think of it before. The name Picker said, the one that Jaghut heard."
She selected a matched pair of Wiccan long knives from her store of weapons and strapped the belt on, low on her hips, offered Antsy a hard grin.
"I'm going to ask the eel."